the InnovaBuzz podcast, helping smart businesses be even more innovative.
Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Welcome to episode number 96 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, designed to help smart businesses with an interest in innovation become even more innovative. In this episode, my guest is Dr. Eileen Ruhoy from the Center for Healing Neurology in Seattle, Washington State, USA. Eileen founded that center with the mission to treat the person, not the disease. This is a fascinating interview with someone who has taken the best of her experience and knowledge from conventional medicine, neurology, and complementary therapies to address people's wellness, not sickness. Now, I really like this approach to health management, and this approach provides many metaphors for business in general, as well as advice for business owners about looking after themselves. Without further ado, then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Dr. Eileen Ruhoy. Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to have with me today on this episode of the InnovaBuzz podcast from Seattle, Washington in the USA, Dr. Eileen Ruhoy, the founder and medical director of the Center for Healing Neurology. Now, Eileen is a medical doctor specializing in neurology and also holds a PhD in environmental science, which we'll learn a little bit how those things fit together on the interview today. At the Center for Healing Neurology, Eileen's mission is to treat the person, not the disease. Her approach is to combine traditional medicine and complementary therapies to treat the whole person, and with the philosophy that the body has an innate ability to keep itself well. So welcome to the podcast, Eileen. It's a great privilege to have you here.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, Nina Radetich suggested that we interview you on the podcast, so big hello to Nina.
Hello, Nina. Thank you again.
So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to our chat today. I'm keen to learn about your practice as a business and how you serve your patients and how you draw on those particular different aspects of medicine and of the body to treat patients and to keep them well. But before we talk about those things, about health and wellness and how that relates to innovation, let's find out a little bit more about you as a person. Now, I know you've had a pretty interesting journey. So did you plan to be a medical professional as a young child?
As far back as I can remember, actually, I always wanted to help people. There were obviously many paths I could have taken, and many have, and I chose to go to medical school. And I had a great experience there and was really excited to learn. But I just sort of also wanted to learn more. And so I then decided to pursue my PhD in environmental toxicology because I believe that, you know, there's a lot of subclinical type of concerns out there where we don't have a real answer to the diagnosis. And so I thought that, well, there's more that's making us not feel well at, you know, what we eat, the water we drink, the air we breathe, the soil that our food is grown in. So I decided to pursue a PhD in environmental science and specifically environmental toxicology. And then I also wanted to find other ways of helping people beyond the conventional route. And so I did a fellowship in integrative medicine. And then following that, I did a lot of work in herbal formulations and taking a lot of intensive courses. And then I sort of capped that off, if you will, with training in medical acupuncture. So I took an acupuncture course for physicians to learn different acupuncture protocols for medical indications. And so I just sort of wanted to bring all of my background and all of my training together to help people in, you know, the different ways that are possible to help people heal.
Okay, that sounds really fascinating, and it's probably a little unusual, really, for because there is this thing in the medical field, I think, where people either believe in the alternative or they believe in the traditional medicines, and you've kind of brought it all together and added another layer with the environmental part to it as well.
I appreciate you saying that, and I completely agree. I think it still exists. I think people sort of tend to believe that they have to take one route versus the other. And I don't really think that's true. I think that all practitioners are, you know, have the patient in patient's interest in their heart and want to treat. And so what I try to do is I refer to it as the best of both worlds or the best of all the worlds. various points. And I try to bring in pieces from each of those worlds to find a more holistic and integrative approach to treating disease. And it's, you know, it's, there isn't always one answer and there isn't always one way to treat things. And so I try to bring that together for patients and letting them see the various possibilities with regard to their healing journey. And I hope that I'm successful at it.
Yeah. Well, what I really like is that, you know, you are focused on the patient. And so it's not about the treatment as such or being attached to a particular philosophy of treatment. It's about having the patient feeling well.
I agree. I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah. And on your website, you put that front and center, really, that you believe every patient is unique and that you partner with patients in their health and well-being.
I do. I really try hard to understand. You know, it's not just about the symptom that they're presenting with or their particular concern on that day of the appointment, because I try hard, as many providers do, to be fair, to understand how this symptom has played a role in the quality of their lives, you know, so how it affects them on a daily basis, how it interferes in their family life, in their, you know, occupational world and their academic life and their social life amongst their peers, amongst their family members, because it always has an impact. There's always some impact. And, you know, some it's easier to read than others. And so some it takes a little bit longer and a couple of more questions and a little bit more digging. But I do think that's an important part of understanding what's going on with them physiologically so that I can really come up with a treatment plan that will help them. So it's very much individualized in what I try to do. I don't see everyone with the same symptom because, as you know, people do come to a doctor's office with a particular concern. And so I try very hard not to just sort of put it in a box. Well, you know, all of these patients have this concern. I feel, because everyone is different and everyone is individual. And so I really take that into account, that while the particular complaint may be the same, the impact that it has on the rest of their physiology as well as the rest of their world is just as important and plays a role in the ultimate management regimen and treatment options that I offer them.
Yeah, I really like that from a lot of aspects. And if you take the concept out of medicine, even, it's around not treating the symptom, but looking at what is the problem and what's the cost of the problem in terms of the person's life, the person's interaction with family and friends, social life and so on, as you said, and then developing a solution that actually deals with the problem and brings about the changes to all those things that it impacts for the positive.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. It's really good. So why have you chosen to take this particular path then? Why do you do what you do?
I really love people. I think that I think helping people is probably the most potent antidepressant that there is. I myself have been through some health challenges over the years. I 2 years ago I was diagnosed with a large brain tumor and underwent brain surgery and had a recovery period. And I had to learn how to navigate the system as a patient, which, to be fair, I didn't have perspective on, but I quickly obtained it. And I think it's important, you know, and I went back to work fairly quickly because I felt that it's part of my identity to help other people. I think it rewards me more than it rewards them sometimes, the fact that I can be there for people and listen to them and come up with ideas of ways that they can feel better for themselves and for their family members. So I think everyone should reach out. You don't have to be a doctor to help other people. I think that being there for others in any way and any presence in any format that you can actually brings you rewards as well. And I like to try to spread that message as well in what I do. So, that piece is very important to me. And when I was going through my health challenges, people were there for me. And so I like to think that I'm paying it forward and paying it back.
I really like that. I like, you know, you said you don't have to be a doctor to help other people, and that it's in helping other people. What did you say? They're just the best antidepressant there is.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's a potent antidepressant.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's quite amazing that, you know, by helping other people, you are helping yourself and you're learning as well, which, you know, comes back to the idea of neurology and taking care of yourself. So it's sort of the full circle.
And that's a good point you make, actually. I do learn from each and every patient. I think that learning is lifelong, no matter what occupation you're in, no matter who you are. And so I learn from each of my patients. They teach me something as well. And so I value all of my patient relationships. I really do.
Hmm. Now, I'm interested, you talk about the role of, you talk about healing neurology and by implication, the role of neurology in helping bodies heal. So I imagine that people come to you with all kinds of symptoms, not necessarily related directly to the brain. So tell us a little bit more about the philosophy underlying that.
I think that, first of all, I love neurology. I love the nervous system, both the central and the peripheral nervous systems, and I think that they control just about everything that we do, or at least play a role in just about everything that we do. So it makes sense to me that people come with symptoms that aren't necessarily, you know, classified as neurologic symptoms. But they also come with neurologic symptoms, but then have, like I said, sort of this added element of, you know, the effect that it has and how it's sort of affected either their mental health or their outlook or their ability to tolerate, you know, stressors in life. So again, I think the healing neurology part just comes from my approach of trying to be integrative, of trying to be holistic, of trying to look for the best of conventional medicine and the best of alternative medicine, whether that be with, you know, herbs or supplements or acupuncture or neurofeedback, which we do a lot of. But I think what's really important is that I tend to really want to understand what's going on before I treat. And so usually when patients come, the first steps are to sort of really focus in on what the concern is and what might be happening to them physiologically. So I always start with a good diagnostic evaluation, and it's fairly comprehensive because I think that information ultimately provides me with more information about them. I'm not only as a person, but how their body is functioning and how their body is working. And then from there, I can bring this integrative approach and then support them through that healing journey, because the interesting thing about alternative therapies is that it doesn't happen overnight. You know, pharmaceuticals happen fairly quickly, but obviously long-term use results in side effects, whereas some of the more natural approaches don't necessarily have the dreaded side effects, but they can take longer to work. And so I'm there for them. I support them through it. We do alternative therapies to help, you know, modify the results that we're hoping to get. And it's all, you know, it's just part of a healing journey, of which I think we're all on some level, regardless of what our health challenges are. I think that our current world sort of provides us with stress enough so that we all have to heal ourselves. And so I focus a lot on stress management and prevention. I think that's an important piece of our well-being, of our optimal wellness, is to focus on ways that we can keep our body in balance. And at the risk of rambling on, I do think that's an important piece of what I'm referring to, in that, our bodies want to heal. They want to be in health. They want to be in balance. And I think that there's a lot of things that go on in our lives and the world around us that could bring us a little bit out of balance. And a little bit out of balance is okay. We could find easy, kind ways to bring it back into balance, to harness the body's own ability to heal. And obviously this is not the case for all diseases, certainly, but for many of them. But once the body gets so far out of balance, it's a little bit harder to do. And so that's where conventional medicine can be very much beneficial and very, very useful. And so I focus a lot on prevention, right, to try to keep that body within that window of balance, if you will, and not get too far out, just so we can really use not only the body's natural ability, but also some of the more alternative approaches, such as what the plant world has to offer us with regards to medicine. So I think, you know, a lot of what I do revolves around stress management and prevention, and, you know, preventative ideas and strategies and lifestyle options, but clearly when things are out of balance, then I do have to put on, you know, the conventional neurologist hat and make sure that I keep them safe and healthy.
Yeah, that's a really in-depth explanation of how you go about it. So it's, I really appreciate that. Now,
I'm passionate about it, so I apologize.
Yeah. I could hear that. That's great. I'm fascinated. I mean, you mentioned the body has an innate ability to kind of keep itself well and to heal itself if something's out of balance. And I'm always fascinated how the body can deal with things and how, yeah, I mean, even if you leave it alone, as long as it's not way out of whack, as you say, and it's not life-threatening, the body will just fix itself. It's, you know, you cut yourself and it heals. It's amazing. And I guess the approach, I really like the approach of the prevention. And I think, I don't know if it's true today, but certainly in the reading about China in the old days, the doctors were paid according to whether their patients were healthy or not. So they weren't. So if you were sick and went to the doctor, they didn't get paid. But if you were healthy and they kept you that way, you got paid. So I guess that might be the Eastern philosophy, is it?
No, I think to be fair, that would be unfair to many specialists. including neurologists, to be frank. But yes, I think, right. So I think that would depend upon the kind of patient that you're seeing, because clearly sometimes patients don't think about coming to a neurologist such as myself until things really are out of balance. And so, you know, it's a little bit harder to sort of get them back into a more healthy and natural state. But we try hard, and again, I try to bring in what the different kinds of modalities have to offer.
So in terms of the, I'm just thinking, in terms of kind of people going to see the doctor because they're unwell, at what point is a neurologist somebody they might consider?
I think the most common reason why people go to see general neurologists are things like headaches, obviously, neuropathy, so what we refer to as paresthesias, which are a numbness or tingling, usually of the legs. Those are probably the most common complaints. Headaches definitely are an issue amongst many. It's a very common concern that a lot of people suffer from. So things like migraines, and there are other kinds of primary headache disorders. And so those are the most common reasons, I would say. I think that in my practice, I definitely see a lot of headache concerns. I see a lot of neuropathy. I do see a lot of anxiety concerns. I see a lot of vertigo, like dizziness, so autonomic kind of complaints. So these are probably the more common concerns that people come with to a neurology practice. Obviously, there are there are subspecialties in neurology. There are neuromuscular, obviously there's epilepsy, there's movement disorders, there's stroke experts. So there are, you know, things like Parkinson's and dementia's experts and Alzheimer's. And so I think there's a wide array of reasons why people seek out a neurologist. And I definitely tend to see the gamut here in my private practice.
Okay. Now, in terms of the neurology and wellness, you talk a lot about food and medicine and the alternative medicines. You mentioned plants. So tell us how particularly food and alternative medicines have a role there in overall wellness.
Okay, this is one of my favorite topics. That food is medicine.
Yeah.
I think that what we eat here, at least in America, I think that has gotten far away from what the plant world has to offer us. And I think that, you know, the rainbow of vegetables and fruits have just about every vitamin, nutrient, amino acid that our body needs. And I think that we just don't eat enough of the proper foods. And I think a lot of the foods that have been designed by man for us to consume are very pro-inflammatory. This is proven. This is not just my opinion. This is science. So a lot of the foods are very pro-inflammatory. And so when we create any level of inflammation, that inflammation results in symptoms. Is it always neurologic symptoms? No, of course not. But it does predispose you to other kinds of disease processes, and it does increase your risk factors for things that neurologists do see, like headaches and like strokes, even neuropathies. But it increases your risk factors for a lot of things that we see in our culture, such as high blood pressure and diabetes and such. But yes, food is medicine. And, you know, we used to look towards the plant world for medicinal purposes, you know, historically and many years ago. And a lot of these plants used to be wild. And, you know, now we have parking lots and shopping malls. And so they have to be grown on herb farms, which is fine. And so we have to purchase them, you know, in extract form or supplement form. But there are medicinal uses of many different plants, and as well as whole foods. I mean, whole foods is what our body recognizes as real nourishment. And so I try to counsel patients. I think that lifestyle management is hard. I think it's a lot harder than prescribing a medication. To change people's behaviors is a very difficult thing to do. I mean, we all form habits, and that those habits are hard to change. And so I think a lot of what I focus on with my patients is I sort of take them through baby steps. Okay, so what small changes can we make in your diet and your lifestyle now that you can do for another month? And I think they appreciate that, because if I sort of, you know, send them on their way with, okay, you know, I want you to change your diet this drastically, and I want you to start exercising 5 days a week and meditate every morning, it won't happen. And I know that, they become discouraged, and that's the last thing that I want, because that's more stress to them. So I try to focus on ways of doing this in the least stressful manner possible, and I try to find at least one pro-inflammatory food that they're eating regularly and ask them to at least minimize it, if not to completely remove it from their diet. I try to find exercises that they enjoy doing and sort of recommend ways of doing it a little bit more often. I try to find ways of making them be more mindful, such as meditation, such as yoga. I do acupuncture for them, because that's a period of time when they can learn to be mindful. And I make these small changes over time. And so it's a very long relationship with my patient, and I find that it has a great response. Those that are motivated to do so and make these changes really do get great benefit. And I always feel like a proud parent, you know. I always feel like, you know, when they come back and say, wow, I did these things, and over the last few months I've had these positive changes, and it does make me beam with pride. And but you know, it's small work, but it's rewarding work, and I do it in piecemeal. And it's just important to recognize that a lot of what our body needs and a lot of what our bodies are asking for really, really is out there in the form of whole foods, in the form of plants. And sometimes when we have a particular symptom because some things have gotten out of balance, it just needs a boost from maybe a particular nutrient or vitamin, or, you know, from a supplement, or a little bit more activity to get the blood flow moving, a little bit more mindfulness to sort of focus in on that organ or that system that's dysfunctioning. And we can do a whole lot with that, quite frankly. And I think that we've all learned maybe not to trust those kinds of things that seem so maybe simple or maybe not real, because they're not, you know, they're not sort of couched in the medicine world, but they really can be powerful when done consistently. You know, absolutely, they really can have powerful, positive effects.
Yeah. I wonder these days, because there's this instant gratification idea or expectation in people's minds, and you see it everywhere, you know, in marketing online, people expect to have magic tricks available that get them business by using the internet, and they expect, you know, magic pills for all kinds of things. So, and I think the idea of Western medicine of, you know, having some sort of medication for a symptom, suppressing the symptom, so you can take a painkiller for a headache and, you know, within 15 minutes it's gone, but the problem itself is still there somewhere. And
that's exactly
and
right.
And the putting in the work, if you like, to address the real issue, such as, you know, changing your diet, getting more exercise, doing different things to address stress factors, kind of isn't consistent with that instant gratification expectation. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I mean, I obviously agree very much, unless anyone think I'm a killjoy. I don't expect anyone not to go out to dinner or not to have fun with their friends. I just like to make them cognizant of when they have choices to make, of trying to find the choice that would be most nourishing and healing to their bodies. And I talk about, I mean, a lot of this is not just, you know, woo-woo and just not just me, and obviously several other providers would agree with me. And it's not just us talking. These are things that have been looked at. I mean, take meditation, for example. There have been studies that have shown that regular meditators actually not only reduce the amount of atrophy of certain regions of the brain, but can actually, in some cases, reverse the atrophy. Atrophy meaning that the tissue has gotten smaller. So there are some areas of the brain that have actually been shown to be responsive to regular meditation, where they become more robust, the volume is increased, and therefore you could extrapolate and say the function is better. And they're certainly at, you know, less risk of some neurodegenerative concerns as we get older. So, and I can go on with examples about that. I mean, a lot of this really is borne out in some research. And I think that a lot of, you know, doctors are really pleased with this, because it does give us other ammunition to offer patients as opposed to just a prescription. So when I explain all the science to patients, I can sort of see them go, oh, wow, so this is not just, you know, you telling me I should meditate. This is you, the doctor, that I would really get some great health benefits from doing so. And so absolutely, I agree. We have to put in the work, but recognize that, you know, putting in the work leads us to a better place.
That's right.
A healthier place. And a place where there's less risk of, you know, becoming sicker as we get older. And of course, that's all of our goal, right? We all want to live long, but we want to live long and well. And so that's my goal, to help other people live long and well. I mean, I want to live long and well, so I practice what I preach, and so I want to share it with others.
Yeah, it's fascinating, the effect of meditation on the brain and on total well-being. And I was listening to a talk by Dr. Fiona Kerr recently. I don't know if you've come across her. She's a specialist in... can't remember the science now, but it's neuro-related. And her point was that, you know, it's well known that we destroy brain cells all the time, but what is perhaps less well known and well appreciated is that we're also always building brain cells, even into, you know, ripe old age, and that there are ways in which we can encourage that building of new brain cells and new neural pathways by doing a bunch of different things. And it comes back to exercise, nutrition, meditation. And the other one that was interesting was interacting with people.
Yes, social connections. So just quickly, I completely agree with that. We are sprouting new brain cells, but most importantly, what we really can control is sort of how they connect with the other cells, right? So those neural pathways that you refer to are what's important here. So, you know, sprouting new cells, unless they connect appropriately and efficiently, really don't do much, right? So it's really making those neural pathways as efficient and effective as possible and as strong. And so that's obviously the most important thing about this, and that's what helps sort of keep our cognition, keep our mood, keep our motivation to move forward in doing things that are right for us. And without question, that then as we get older, we have less of a risk of those kind of neurodegenerative concerns. And I'm sorry, and you said a second point that I wanted to respond to.
Yeah.
We were talking about the neural pathways, and she also said something else about what was the second point that she had made?
She had a bunch of things as recommendations in terms of enhancing
exercise. That's right.
Exercise. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I preach exercise. I think a lot of people think about exercise for weight control, and we do. That diet is probably 80% of weight control, but exercise, when it comes to health, is so important, because it does get blood flow moving, and it challenges not only our heart, obviously, and our lungs and our muscles, which are important. It challenges our brain, and it gets the blood flow moving up into the brain. I mean, working into the cerebral vasculature is extremely important, because we need to perfuse our brain with consistent and healthy oxygen flow. And so the way to do that, of course, is to eat well, because then you supply the body with the nutrients and vitamins it needs, and then to exercise appropriately to take in that oxygen and then allow the blood to be pushed up into the brain that's delivering all these great nutrients and vitamins and oxygen to the brain tissues, because that is very important. And in fact, we do see very often as we age, and we get MRIs on people of, you know, even in their, I've seen it as early as the fourth decade, but usually in older decades, you see evidence of what we refer to as microvascular ischemia, which just means that all of the small vessels of the brain were not receiving a proper blood flow, basically, and didn't get enough oxygen. And so those small vessels start to sort of degenerate, if you will. And so we see evidence of that in MRIs. I mean, the brain is fed from, you know, large vessels to moderate-sized vessels, and it expands out to very small vessels that feed all the different remote regions of the brain. And it's those small vessels that are most vulnerable to aging processes, of course, but specifically to what occurs to us over decades of living, which is, you know, poor food, poor exercise, poor sleep, stress, anxiety, depression. All of that really does have a physiologic effect on our blood flow. And as I said, those small vessels are the most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. But one of the most powerful ways of keeping those small vessels happy and healthy, if you will, are to exercise, you know, get that blood going, challenge your brain with different exercises to sort of work, you know, recruit different functions, different regions of the brain so that does different kinds of functions, whether it's for balance or for strength or for aerobic, or even yoga, which, you know, is meditative in its in some of its aspects. So yes, I couldn't talk about exercise enough. I love it, and I think everyone should do it. And you know, and I always say to patients, you don't have to climb Mount Everest tomorrow. You know, you don't have to do a triathlon next week. You know, it really can be as simple as walking, getting outdoors. It could, you know, yoga, meditation. You know, all these things really do affect the brain function and the health of the brain, which is what I'm really about.
Idea of exercise, and I'm a big fan of exercise, and I find, particularly as a business owner or as somebody that, you know, there's other stresses in life, that getting out and exercising in the fresh air also has a meditative effect, because my mind switches off and I start to get other ideas and other things are happening. You know, that all these things just bubble up from the unconscious every now and then when I'm out exercising, particularly if I'm on my own and not talking at all. So I've just come back from my morning bike ride this morning. We've got a beautiful spring morning, so it's crisp and cool, wonderful fresh air, and I was just filled with gratitude when I was out there this morning. It's just brilliant. So you get all these effects. It's wonderful.
Absolutely. I agree. Well, being out in nature, we also know has a great, it's also an antidepressant. When I was doing my PhD in environmental toxicology, I worked for some of the urban planning department people at the EPA. And that's one thing that we talked about, that even in an urban setting, how do we get a great park in that area for not only the kids, but the adults to get some exercise? Because we do know that exercise out in nature has exponential effects as opposed to exercise in a gym. Now, clearly in the dead of the winter when it's, you know, dark and dreary, obviously if the gym is the only place, then by all means, it's a good alternative. But whatever you can get outdoors and do exercise, you're getting exponential benefits from it. And you actually just spoke to many of them. So I agree with that completely.
Hmm. So what tips would you give? You know, I guess a lot of the audience are business owners, and with a lot of day-to-day pressures and dealing with a whole lot of things in their business that might stretch that balance that we talked about earlier. What kind of tips would you give to those people to stay in balance or restore balance and stay in balance?
I think that's a great question, and one that I grapple with as well. I think it's just setting some priorities. So, for example, sleep should be a priority for brain health. We know that poor sleep hygiene, any kind of sleep dysfunction definitely results in things like depression and anxiety, cognitive concerns as we get older. So sleep should be a priority no matter how busy you are. You know, there should be a time at night when you decide, okay, I'm not going to do any more work. I'm going to shut everything down. I'm going to get myself ready for bed and start to calm yourself. Wake up I always say that circadian, you know, we are circadian beings. We evolve to basically go to sleep when the sun sets and rise when the sun rises. That's obviously not always possible. As much as we can respect that and have that sentiment in what we do and simulate that, I think our brain is grateful because our brain is a circadian organ. So I always suggest trying to go to sleep at the same time each night and then waking up at the same time each morning. That can be very effective. And that simple change actually can be extremely beneficial. So that's one thing that I always say to prioritize is sleep. And then the exercise is an important piece. And again, it doesn't have to be extensive and it doesn't have to be long. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be strenuous all the time. Go outside and walk for 20 minutes. If you have a pet, go walk the dog. I think that we can all find 20 minutes of our day to go for a walk if we had to. And obviously, if you can do more, that would be great. But if it just starts with going for a walk at 20 minutes midday, early in the morning before the day starts, or even at night before you wind down for bed, that's fine as well. And then, of course, the foods. I mean, I think that at every meal, there's an opportunity to make a good choice, to make a choice of either a pro-inflammatory food or an anti-inflammatory food. And not all anti-inflammatory foods taste poor. I mean, some of them actually taste pretty good. They're actually pretty decent. I mean, I think that you could find different ways of preparing them. And but so every meal is a chance to sort of feed your body something that's anti-inflammatory that won't contribute to the inflammation that likely exists to some baseline level in all of us and to some, more of a baseline. So I think that the meal choices are just as important. So it's really about a prioritization of what you can do in a given day. I always say take one day at a time because I know that in my world, I find that some days I actually have quite a bit of freedom to make choices of what I want to do with my day. Some days I have no choices. And so I just sort of take one day at a time. Once the day has passed, I put it behind me and I don't think about it again. Yesterday, I say was not a great day. I didn't get a chance to do these few things for myself and for my health, but today is a new day and I'm going to try to fit it in. And so, a day at a time is all any one of us can do, quite frankly. And so, again, to think too far ahead about what I can do in the next coming month is just creating more stress, and that doesn't suit any of us. So baby steps, I think it's important. And as long as we have priorities, those baby steps become a little bit easier because we know what our priorities are.
Mm. And we know why we're doing it and the direction we're headed.
Exactly.
Hmm. All right. Well, it's fascinating. And I love that you said sleep as the first priority because I'm going back to the talk that Fiona Kerr gave. I think sleep was the fifth one that I neglected to mention in that list of five that she gave. She made a very strong point about a minimum of 7 hours sleep, but she also talked about naps during the day and naps that were short naps so that you didn't get into this deep sleep state and struggle to actually get back out of that and wake up.
Right. I mean, and I do agree with that. I think it's hard for a lot of, as you said, a lot of your audience are business people. I mean, it's very difficult to take naps during the day when you're running a business, working in someone else's business and have a busy, schedule, people have families, obviously. So I think naps are difficult, but I do agree that at least 7 hours at night is important because, we do need restorative sleep. Studies have shown that when you learn something new in a given day, it doesn't matter about the night of sleep you had prior to that day. It matters about the night of sleep you have following that day. So for consolidation of that new lesson, the sleep that you get following that lesson is actually more important. So if you didn't sleep well last night and I were to teach you something new here in our conversation, if you slept well tonight, you would recall that lesson and our details of our conversation, even though you hadn't slept well the night before, in other words. So sleep is just important in general for consolidation of memories, consolidation of learning, reducing the risk of cognitive difficulties as we get older, reducing the risk of depression and anxiety. And actually, a lot of different neurological diseases are also associated with poor sleep. So I think that sleep is a huge priority, yes, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. All right. Now, in terms of your own business or your practice, what are the biggest challenges you face?
I think the largest challenges is that I want to help all, and it's hard to do, obviously, in a clinic setting, to make patients, you know, they have to come in for appointments. So my goal of trying to sort of be a doctor for everyone is challenging in a private practice setting. I think that to get my messages out, I want to sort of do it more for the masses, which is why I was really excited to have this conversation with you today. I want to just help more people. I think, but from a business perspective, I think that it's challenging. I think healthcare in general is challenging. It's different from other kinds of businesses. I think that insurances make it challenging, and so that's a bit of an obstacle sometimes with regards to, you know, reimbursement and payment, and that's the financial concerns. But and then, as I said sort of earlier, you know, I work a lot regarding you know, changes of behaviors, and so that could be challenging, but I always feel like I'm up for the challenge. I always say to patients that, you know, they can call me or write me with any obstacle that they come to, because I always have an answer for it. I don't feel there's any obstacle that's insurmountable. And so, but obviously human behavior can be difficult. So I think that there are business challenges. I think that there's just human challenges that I deal with on a regular basis, but I welcome it, and I just always cross my fingers and hope for the best and hope that I can continue to do what I love.
Mm. Fascinating. So changes in behavior, you mentioned that as a challenge, and so how do you go about, so let's say somebody comes in, they've got an issue, they need to change the things that they're doing, and it comes back to changes in behavior, and so how do you kind of hold the space for them, if you like? How are you there for them to help them make that change?
Well, I try to give access to me. We have a patient portal that my patients use fairly often. They can always call. But I'm also very understanding. I mean, I try not to be rigid for them, because I don't want them to feel like they can't express that they maybe were not able to follow every recommendation on each day. So I try to make them comfortable with me, know that I'm accessible, that I'm understanding that this is difficult, that this is a complete change of what they've done in the last 30, 40 years of their lives. And I give them ideas, and I give them options, and I come up with thoughts of ways we can go around their particular concern or their particular obstacle or things that they find hard or difficult to do. I find substitutes for things that, you know, they may not like apples or cucumbers. You know, I come up with different substitutes for things. They may not like a particular exercise. I find that they don't have the time. So I sort of help them sort that out in their lives and figure out what they need to do in order to free themselves up to make those good changes for that, because it's really ultimately for their health. And so, and they see that. So I just try to be available and supportive as best as I can. I never get angry. I mean, I always, you know, there's always a space for them. I always hold them, you know, not physically. I mean, support them and nurture them. So some patients are, you know, very motivated and are not that big of a challenge. And some patients are, you know, haven't gotten to that point yet, and that's okay. It takes us all some time. It really does.
Mm. Okay.
What I try to do is I try to avoid having a life tragedy to have them make those changes, right? I always feel that once we're struck with a disease or a degenerative process, things become a lot harder. And not that there aren't some things that we can do, and and I still work with them, but for a lot of my patients, I want them to sort of, you know, get ahead of those things that could happen to us in life. And so the best that we can support our systems to be healthy and happy and, you know, less inflamed, the better off we all will be and the better we'll feel. And that then sort of extends into how we interact with others, how we modulate our responses to stress, how we even perform our activities of daily living. It just makes things a lot easier and a lot and better. So I try to be preventative in our approach, but sometimes, you know, they come to me a little bit later when things are already happening. And so I work with them from that angle. So I guess it's an individualized approach depending upon the patient and who they are and what they're currently facing and what they are interested in doing. And I respect their choices. So,
Well, I mean, you raised a couple of points there in terms of, well, earlier you said, you know, helping more people on a one-to-many level, and I wonder how you get that message out there. And what you've talked about just now suggests that, you know, people will probably come to you when they've got a symptom, and it may be an advanced symptom, in which case it's a remedial situation to start with until you get to that point of, okay, now let's get this balance right and let's put behaviours and practices in place that will keep you well. But how do you get people on board before they have those symptoms and before there's triage necessary, if you like?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. It's hard, as you know. Most people don't think about coming to see a doctor until there's a problem, until they're feeling something that's just not right. Most people certainly aren't referred to neurologists until something is not right. So I will say that primary care providers probably have a lot more success at getting people before a disease process takes hold. I think in the neurology world, people aren't seeing us until something is clearly wrong. It doesn't mean that we can't resolve it or cure it. In fact, many times we can, but oftentimes we can't. And so it does take a more, as you say, a remedial approach. And so I struggle with that too. That's actually one of the things that I'm working on in my business, which is that how do I get people to come see me before they really need me? And I think that that's a good that's a challenge. Yeah. So that's one of my challenges, obviously, is to how to get people to understand that that they can't, you know, sometimes you just can't do it all on your own. You need someone to help. You need some guidance. You need somebody to teach and guide and motivate and educate, by the way. Education is a huge part of what I do. I educate a lot of people on foods as medicine and herbs and as medicine and exercise as medicine. I do a lot of education along those lines, and but I'd like to do it for more. So yes, how do I get people who come to see me before they actually know they need me?
yeah,
that's the question. I need the answer.
All right. So how do you go about the education process as a challenge to that problem? Because I was going to go down the education path, and I thought, well, you probably do a lot of presentations at various conventions or in medical forums, but how do you get that education to the public?
Right. So that is what I'm working on. I'm actually working currently on a series of videos. I have a team of videographers that are helping me. I sort of have a series of food as medicine, and I tackle each video a different complaint. Like one is headaches, one is anxiety and depression. And I focus on foods and plants that are particularly helpful. I mean, I talk about with depression, for example, and anxiety, foods that help to boost dopamine function. I talk about with migraines. There are known foods to be triggered for migraines. There are known foods to be very pro-inflammatory, to put you at greater risk for migraines. There are known foods to actually help quell the inflammation that results in migraines. So I tackle foods for things like MS and foods for Parkinson's disease. And so it's going to be a series of videos. So as you probably know, my practice is only open a little over a year. So it's fairly a new business, and I sort of had to get going. And so a lot of things are sort of on deck, if you will, of plans that I have to get my message out to more people who live outside of my vicinity. So yes, that's all coming down the pike. I like I said, the video series is my first thought, and then I write blogs for a website, Mind Body Green. They regularly post my blogs, and that's another way that I'm communicating to others who don't necessarily live close by to my practice. There are all these different forms that I'm looking into to try to, as I said, get people to make changes in their world and in their lives and in their choices to help them be healthier for the rest of their lives as much as we possibly can.
All right. So Mind Body Green, will have a link to that in the show notes of the episode. And also if there's any videos already live, we'll post links to those as well.
Oh, thank you. The first one will be live next month, actually. So, but if I can send them to you, I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, please do. All right. Well, I really appreciate this. It's been a fascinating discussion. I'd like to move on to the buzz, which is our innovation round. And these are more business questions, so feel free to take them where you want. They're essentially designed to help the audience who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field with some tips from your experience. And so there's five questions and hopefully we'll get some really insightful answers.
Okay, great.
So what's the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Take risks. Yeah, I mean, I had to get over my fear of not worrying what other people think. I mean, I come from a very conventional, I know, and I realize this is, you know, this is talking to not necessarily other physicians, but my own personal story is I come from a very conventional medical background. And so I had to be willing to sort of, you know, risk how my colleagues would think of me trying to do a more alternative integrative approach. And so it took me a couple of years, to be honest, but I was able to sort of realize that this is what I know to be true. And this is what I love and am passionate about. And I took the risk and it has, you know, my fears were not realized, let's put it that way. It's been received very well amongst my community, and so take risks is what I can say. Do not fear what other people will think or say.
Oh, fabulous advice. Yeah, I love that. Oh, don't worry about what other people will say or think or what you think they might think. And follow your passion as well, I heard in there.
Yes.
All right, so what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
I have literally taken everything that I know to be true from a conventional world and taken everything I know to be true from an alternative world, and I've put them together and made them seamless, right? So a lot of things from two different worlds will clash. So from two different ideas, you might have things that might clash. And so the goal is to find ways to sort of mold those ideas so that they don't clash, so that they sort of meld together. So it becomes one big idea that's just useful for whoever your customer is. In my case, obviously, it was ideas from the conventional world, ideas from the alternative world. I brought them together. I made it into a nice packaged plan that was beneficial for patients, and it has worked very well. So, again, melding ideas so that they're seamless, so there are no holes, right? So that it's a finished product and it's useful and beneficial and worthy. And so that would be my suggestion.
Great advice. And yeah, you've demonstrated a perfect example of how that works. All right. So do you have a favorite tool or system for improving your own productivity and allowing you to be more innovative?
I have not found one yet. I'm forced to use electronic medical record systems and they're all clunky by nature. So I don't know if I'm the best person to offer advice along those lines. In the medical world, our software, we're sort of bound by HIPAA laws, which are privacy laws for patients. That creates a lot of non-efficient kind of computer systems and methods of communication with patients. So I feel that my experience probably is not the best along those lines, to be honest.
What about in terms of, your general education stuff that you put online or videos?
Yeah, That is true. I mean, so the video series that we're using, I know that the team, they have a video platform. I actually don't know the name of it just yet, but I know that there are platforms out there that allow you to put videos, you know, for content. And so that has been actually the most useful thing that I have found. I think that these days, social media certainly, and then a lot of these different softwares that allow you to post videos and advertise them actually to the population of the world, can really make marketing so much more effective than when I was young, when none of this existed. So I do find that, you know, that part of the internet, and again, I'm not an expert on it, and that's why I hired a team to do my videos. But I do find that is certainly has shown to be a very efficient and effective way of getting my message out there to a larger population.
That's great. Yeah, the power of video is amazing these days. And I had an email just this morning from a lady that we'll have on the podcast shortly who specializes in doing live video. So essentially through Facebook or other avenues, having it actually a live and interactive video. So it's kind of like TV, talkback TV, I'm trying to think. I don't know what the right word for that is, but so people can comment on the video and ask questions live of the presenters.
Yeah, I have seen that on Facebook, actually. I have seen that. So apparently people know how to do that. Yeah, I haven't even learned yet. I will. Soon you'll see me on one of those.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I do it from time to time. My challenge with that is the internet connectivity here is not quite up to scratch to do that. But, yeah, it's a very powerful tool. All right. So what's the best way then to keep a patient on track, I'll say, in terms of their programs?
I make them accountable. I ask them to write journals out for me, and I ask them to be honest. I check in with them from time to time. I do have packages for patients who want lots of contact with me to keep them on in line. So with those, I have much more contact, but with others, I still communicate. And I just ask them to mark in a journal how they've done. We list the objectives, we list the recommendations, and we meet from time to time and go over how they've met those objectives. So, a lot of my patients are using software to do this. I don't necessarily insist on it. They could just do it with pen and paper, but that seems to be, going the way of the dinosaurs. But some use software, certainly. But I keep them accountable. I do. I think that the only way that I can be honest with them and continue to guide them appropriately is if they're honest with me. It's a two-way relationship. So, and they understand that. So I don't really have a huge problem with that.
Hmm. That's great. Yeah, I like the idea of writing a journal to keep track of doing what you said you'd do and being accountable. All right, that's great. Then what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Find what you're uniquely passionate about and exploit it as much as possible. Find where your strong points are, what people like about you, who you are, and what you love. And that might sound like a lot, but it all sort of speaks to the same thing about what your core is. And where it sits, so that you're happy with yourself when you go to bed at night, and you're happy with yourself when you wake up in the morning and excited to go to work. So if you find that core of who you are and use that to promote yourself and your business, people will respond. Build it and they will come. And so, but if you're not true to who you really are and doing it for alternative agendas, then likely people will eventually sort of see through that. But be true to yourself. I can vouch for the fact that that really does go a long way in business. And it might sound that that's somewhat contradictory, but it's not. It is not. And the most successful business people that I know were true to what they believe in. So,
That's really good advice. I think, I'm a big fan of learning by modeling and modeling off successful people, but there's a trend to take that too far in terms of just copying what they do rather than understanding what they do and applying the principles within your own, as you said, your own unique passion or your own unique personality, which is, comes back to the second point you made about combining and melding together things that might seem disparate but can be brought together to enhance both and what you're offering.
Yes.
Okay, so what's the future for you then and for the Center for Healing Neurology?
I hope it's a long future. I mean, I hope to expand and offer more services. There's a lot that we want to offer in the future that we're a new business, so we sort of have to do it slowly, but I look forward to continuing to offer the good service that we do and offer the good care that we have to offer, and to continue to bring patients into our community to help guide them through health for decades to come and to keep them well as best as we possibly can. And so I just hope to continue doing more of what we're doing. And as I said, my goal is ultimately to expand it beyond Seattle, Washington.
All right. So So this has really been fantastic, Eileen. I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing your passion with us and sharing your advice. What's the number one piece of advice you'd give to any business who wants to be a leader in innovation and in their field?
Never stop thinking. Never stop innovating. Never stop thinking about what more can be done, what further developments need to be made. Where there are holes in your business industry that can be filled, where niche, you know, and, you know, with every year that goes by us, there are new niches that develop. And so take advantage of those because times are always changing, even in businesses that have been around for a very long time. Things always change. Things never stay the same. That's a certainty in life. Mm. And so sort of try to capitalize on what the changes are and sort of see where you can fill the need. And I think if you do that, and that's certainly what I'm trying to do in my own world and in my community of healthcare, then you'll always be successful. There'll always be a need for who you are and what you have to offer people.
Fantastic. So I heard, I can't remember who said this, is that the one thing that never changes is that things are always changing.
That's correct. That's a wise person.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again, Eileen. Where can people reach out and say thank you for all that you've shared with us today?
They could email me. My email address is Eileen, I-L-E-N-E, at centerforhealingneurology.com. So they can certainly email me. And they can visit the website, Center for Healing Neurology, www.centerforhealingneurology.com. And then I have a Facebook page as well, and it's under Center for Healing Neurology. So all they need to do is search it, and they'll find it.
Okay, and we'll have links to that in the show notes as well to make it even easier. Finally then, who would you like me to interview on a future InnovaBuzz podcast, and why?
Oh, who? Joe Brotherton. He's phenomenal. He owns several companies out here in Seattle. He owns Dobay, which is a meditative retreat type of sort out in the San Juan Islands, but also owns a company called Democracy Live, in which he's trying to create electronic ballots for voting. And he's also a great property owner. He's a phenomenal landlord, and he cares about people. He helps run a charity organization called Tips for Teens. He holds fundraising events. He's just a remarkable human being and a business owner of many businesses, as I said. And he's just also a very fun guy. So
sounds fascinating. So, Joe, look out for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Eileen Ruhoy. Well, thanks again, Eileen. Thanks. I really appreciate you sharing your time and your insights with us on the InnovaBuzz podcast. And I've really enjoyed this. I've learned some more, added to my knowledge. And as you say, keep learning. That's one way to keep those neural pathways fresh and building new ones. So I wish you all the best for the future and for the Center for Healing Neurology and all your videos that you're doing. And let's keep in touch.
I really enjoyed this conversation, and I greatly appreciate it, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed hearing from Eileen as much as I did. She's very passionate about helping people achieve their best health and getting the message of general wellness out to a wider audience. This episode is full of good advice about health and, as I said at the beginning, contains many metaphors for business. All the great ideas and tips that Eileen shared with us can be found at innovabiz.com.au/healingneurology. That is HEALINGNEUROLOGY. HEALINGNEUROLOGY. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.com.au/healingneurology. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Eileen there. We'd love to hear about your experience in managing your health as a business owner and what you'll do as a result of Eileen's suggestions in the comments below the blog post. I'm also fascinated by using the health business that Eileen has built up and marrying up the conventional medicine together with alternative therapies as a metaphor for business. So I'd love to hear what you've taken out of this episode by way of a metaphor for business. Now, Eileen suggested that I interview Joe Brotherton, who is the owner of several businesses based in Seattle, Washington, on a future InnovaBuzz podcast. So Joe, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Dr. Eileen Ruhoy of the Center for Healing Neurology. If you haven't already done so, head on over to iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Casts and subscribe to the InnovaBuzz podcast so you'll never miss a future episode. Of course, we're always looking for feedback and reviews so that we know how we're doing. If there's anything you'd like us to cover, questions you want answered on a future InnovaBuzz podcast, or guests you'd like us to interview, please send those ideas to us. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Be awesome and keep innovating.